pro-choice liberal feminazi slut Rush Limbaugh warned you about. It's Start Me Up.
Start Me Up.
With Kimberly A. Johnson.
Happy Halloween. This is my bonus show. And what that means is usually this show would be for subscribers only who are donating $10 a month. But I'm going to make it free because I think it's going to be a good show. And I just wanted you to get a little taste of what these kinds of extra shows, bonus shows are. Just some fun conversation. And my guest a little later is going to be Bob Seska. He writes for The Daily Banter and Salon, and he has a podcast called The Bob and Chez Show. But before he comes on, I wanna bitch and complain about something. I'm a little pissed off because I posted about this on Facebook. But in 2013, some friends of mine, some ERA activist friends, Equal Rights Amendment activist friends, created a petition, a White House petition, to get Obama to acknowledge and talk about the fact that the ERA had a congressionally imposed expired deadline. So they wanted that deadline to be removed. Obviously, Obama can't remove it, but he could talk about it. The White House could address it. And that's what happens when you have a White House petition. It's, you know, when you get the required signatures, then the president usually addresses that issue in a public way. So we did get the required signatures, and we all worked, you know, I found it online as I was, perusing one day, and I became friends with these women, who created this petition after I found it online. And I posted about it on many Facebook groups and pages, and eventually, even though it was like pulling teeth, because people don't fully understand that we don't have it or what it, you know, what it would mean, for people in this country to have the Equal Rights Amendment, we did get the required signatures. And, you know, months and months later, the creators of the White House petition got a letter. It was from the White House. And it was, you know, just kind of dismissive. Yeah, we got it. And that was it. And I have to say that the people who created it were upset. I mean, they were disappointed more than anything. I was pissed off. But we decided not to make a federal case out of it because, you know, angry, hysterical women and all. So anyway, cut to Bill Maher wants Obama to be a guest on his show. So Bill Maher created a White House petition. And at the, you know, I think at the time, the one that was created in 2013 only required 25,000 signatures. And it, right after that, it became they changed it to where you now need 100,000 signatures. So Bill Maher created this petition, and obviously he's very popular, and that petition filled up very soon. I don't know how long it took, a week or less or something like that. So Obama did address it and, you know, said something along the lines of that they watch the show, Bill's show. And now I wake up this morning and I see that he you know, has agreed to be on Bill Maher's show, which I'm very happy about. I think I even signed the petition. I will watch that show, and I will probably enjoy the interview. But it makes me angry. And I love Bill Maher, and I think Obama is a great president. But it really pisses me off that Obama isn't talking about it. Nobody's talking about it. You know, as a president, he's not going to, you know, sign something and all of a sudden it means that we're going to have the Equal Rights Amendment, which is basically a protection, a constitutional protection against gender discrimination. It would just be nice, like when he talked about marriage equality and he talked in favor of it, it brings it into the public conversation. It makes more people aware of it. And why can't he just do that for the Equal Rights Amendment? I kind of do understand, but I really just don't understand. And when I say I kind of understand, it's because it has to do with women. Even though the Equal Rights Amendment wouldn't only protect women, women are the ones who are going to benefit from it because more women are victims of gender discrimination than men. And that's just the truth. And that's why we don't talk about it. And, you know, I mean, I have the same beef with Hillary. I'm going to give her a bit of a pass on this because I don't know exactly what her plan is. For all I know, she might be holding out, and, you know, maybe once she's elected, she'll bring it up and talk about it too. I don't know. If she doesn't, I'm going to be pissed and I'm going to be on her ass about it. But I'm just, you know, I'm putting it out there. I'm pissed off that Obama is going to be on Bill Maher's show, but he couldn't even be bothered to mention the ERA when he already talks about, you know, women's rights, and obviously he's not against it. So I wish he would just say something. So anyway, there's my rant. And then I don't know if you happened to catch my last article on Huffington Post, but I was also pissed off because, you know, I'm an angry feminist. I was pissed off at Newt Gingrich for yelling at Megyn Kelly and wagging his chubby little finger at her when she was talking about, you know, she asked if Donald Trump is a sexual predator, and then he lost his shit. So if you haven't read it, it's called Open Letter to Newt Gingrich from an Angry Sex-Obsessed Woman, and it's on the Huffington Post. I'm not going to read it here, but it did pretty well. So if you're interested, people liked it. I can't stand that man. Ugh. Okay, so let's see. What else? Anything else I'm pissed? I'm pissed off today because when I woke up, I saw this thing on Bill Maher, and that just got me going. And then every little thing, you know, I'm seeing people saying stupid things on Facebook, and I'm getting highly irritated. So maybe what I should just do in order to get past my anger is just introduce Bob. because I don't know, I'll just rant all day long. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to introduce Bob Seska now. As I said, he writes for Salon, and he's also written for the Huffington Post, and he writes for Daily Banter. He's a libtard. I know I'm not supposed to say that, but I'm going to say it anyway. And he has a podcast called The Bob and Chez Show. So I'm looking forward to this conversation. It should be interesting. Oh, and also my cat, Miranda, is going to join us.
This is Start Me Up with Kimberly A. Johnson.
Okay. Hello, Bob.
Hi. Hi. I'm just so curious about the use of this music for the show that I'm the guest on. Should I tuck my genitals between my legs?
Yes. Do it. Do it and then post it on Facebook.
So I assume this is Halloween themed. The
yes,
use of
because
this.
Because full disclosure, you're my producer.
Yeah,
and you're also my boyfriend.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I wanted to play Monster Mash, but no. Evidently, everyone hates that song, even though I don't. And so you know, when you told me that you didn't want to play Monster Mash, this was the obvious choice.
Oh my god. Yeah, see, now I spent a lot of time in radio. I should explain my objection to Monster Mash. I spent a lot of time in radio, and every Halloween in radio, you have to play Monster Mash at least once an hour. It's like Christmas time, you gotta play Grandma Got Run Over by a Reindeer. And so it's both of these songs that I try to avoid like the plague every time Halloween or Christmas rolls around. So that's why. Monster Mash, are you kidding me? No.
Well, I like the song anyway, although I still do like Monster Mash.
Yeah.
I always will. But, oh my God, I love Silence of the Lambs, and I love this song, and it's such a creepy movie. And we're going to have to watch that again.
Yeah, like maybe tonight.
Yeah.
Jesus. Yeah, no, I mean, your listeners don't fully understand how well you know that movie.
Yeah,
Silence of the Lambs.
I can probably recite it as I'm watching it. And, you know, I had this friend who also enjoyed Silence of the Lambs. And we used to just constantly talk about it and laugh. And I don't remember the name of this place. But, you know, I was with my dad, who was a Marine. And we were at the Marine Museum.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And so that's where the FBI training
facility near Quantico. Yeah.
So I was, and I didn't know that. So I was there, I can't remember, I think it was like 2009. And we're going through, and I said to my father, I'm like, wow, this really looks like where they filmed Silence of the Lambs. He's like, it is. And I'm like, oh my God. And then I just kept quoting Silence of the Lambs and like texting my friend, and we were laughing. You know, I love that movie. It's so creepy, but I love it.
I knew you were a fangirl when at one point you made a reference. I forget how long ago it was. You made a reference to Frederica Bimmel's underwear. I was like, oh my God. So she noticed Frederica Bimmel's underpants.
Well, you know what's funny?
And then the Polaroid hidden in the music box.
There's this woman on Facebook. On Twitter. And I believe her Twitter handle is Bimmerella. And every single time I see it, I think of Frederica
Bimmel. And is that intentionally? Did she do that intentionally?
I don't know. She's a feminist, but I don't know what... Maybe that's just her. I don't know what the deal is. But every time I see Bimmerella, I just think of that movie.
Yeah. Now, as a feminist, what do you think of that movie? It's obviously a feminist movie. It very much is. I always thought it was.
I never thought of it in terms of feminism. In fact, before I became an online feminist, I never really introduced myself to anybody like, hi, I'm Kimberly and I'm a feminist.
Yeah.
That didn't really start until the Tea Party came in and started, you know, going ape shit on women's rights and all the legislation. So, you know, prior to, I've always been a feminist because I believe men and women are equal or should be equal, but...
No, they shouldn't.
I know. Women should have more rights than men.
That's right. But, well, no, I mean, it is. It actually very much is. I mean, there's entire storylines in Silence of the Lambs that are, or I shouldn't say storylines, but there's an ongoing theme of Clarice not
true.
Being taken
that's
seriously
when
because
she
she's
shut
a
down.
Woman.
Yeah, when she got shut down and told us she couldn't join that one conversation.
Yeah.
And
that's right.
And she said that it matters. You know?
And then who's the God? The name slips my mind, but the director of the mental institution where Hannibal Lecter
oh,
is.
Oh yeah,
and he's hitting on her too, and she's got to navigate that. and then Miggs.
Miggs. Oh my God. That's so Miggs. Disgusting. You know what? All of the blood scenes and everything, I can take that. But the Miggs. That is so. Freaking nasty.
I don't think your reaction is an outlier. I think that's the reaction. Everybody goes, oh my God. Was that what I thought it was?
And she just had this look on her face like, you know, I'm just going to be strong. And it's like, oh God, I would just start crying and I would like need hazmat. And
yeah. I mean, that's where you got to take your hat off to both Jodie Foster and Jonathan Demme. They must have done a bunch of different takes of Clarice getting hit in the face with cum, and it must have been just horrifying. All right, take 32, Miggs, cue Miggs. Oh my God, horrible.
The guy who has to get the cum prop. So
yes.
Gross.
Can we get more cum from Miggs in the cell? Someone bring
that is
Miggs
so disgusting.
More. Prop cum.
I heard that Michelle Pfeiffer was originally. Asked to play Clarice.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, she's great. She just wouldn't. I think I can only imagine Jodie Foster in that role. I mean, who played her after? Julianne Moore played her in the second movie.
Yeah.
Which was still okay, except she was doing an impression of Jodie Foster throughout that second movie.
Yeah. And you know what? I don't even remember the second movie. So it didn't.
Yeah, it was with Gary Oldman played Mason Verger with the, you know, he was a victim of Hannibal Lecter, and Hannibal Lecter like ate his entire face off and he survived.
Yeah, I do vaguely remember, but I mean, definitely Silence of the Lambs sticks out. It's one of my favorite. I love psychological thrillers and it's so dark, and it's like, you know, I love Silence of the Lambs because it's dark and creepy. Mm-hmm. And then on the other end of creepy, scary movies that I love American Psycho, but for completely different reasons. Like, it's so fascinating to me that movie is like bright and happy sounding music. And, you know, yet the lead character is this psycho serial killer.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And that also is a movie that was directed by a woman.
Really?
Yep.
I did not know that.
Yeah, of course it was Bret Easton Ellis who wrote the book, but who was the director? Mary Herron directed that movie.
Hmm.
Yeah. And so it's I think what she was able to do was take that source material from Bret Easton Ellis, who's a notorious chauvinist to say the least, and turn it into something that I thought was much more tasteful, I should say, than the book actually was.
Huh.
Which you see quite a bit of, but I mean in this case it actually worked very, very well. I think if she had directly adapted the book, it would have been much more difficult to watch.
Wow. I mean, and it's, you know, I don't know how many times I've seen that movie. Let's say I've seen it 6 or 7 times.
Yeah.
It's so, I don't know that I can ever watch it again, because what happened to me the last time that I watched it was I start to anticipate certain scenes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you don't really, you don't see violence per se, but it's just the idea of what he's doing.
Yeah.
And it's so unnerving and uncomfortable that I don't know, maybe down the road I'll watch again, but it's quite hard, but it's such a brilliant film. If you like psychological thrillers, I mean, I think it's one of the best.
Yeah. And if you're following the election right now, you can see the early version of Donald Trump, Patrick Bateman.
Except I think Patrick Bateman is a little smarter.
That's true. Better hair.
Yeah, way better hair.
Better morning routine than Donald Trump. Donald Trump's morning routine is basically to make that coif actually work. Take that 9-foot-long comb over and swirl it around on his head a few times, and then put on the orange foundation, and that's it. There's no stomach crunch, no 1,000 stomach crunches going on at the Trump on the 87th floor of Trump Tower.
Oh God. So you know, I wanted to ask you. You wrote a piece at Banter yesterday. Yep. About the email scandal, the latest email scandal. So, because you can talk about this so much better than I can, why don't you give the lowdown?
Well, I mean, one of the things that I've been covering quite a lot for the Daily Banter of the last 3 years is bad journalism. I don't think it's any surprise to people who know my work to know that I've spent quite a bit of time evaluating what I see as basically damage that online journalism is doing to the discourse, which is the idea that we need to get a breaking news story out as quickly as possible without concerning ourselves with facts. And that's what happens so often now. Everyone wants to be the first with a story. And so they put it out there, and then it's loaded with bullshit. And then, I mean, by the time they correct the bullshit mm-hmm. version of the story has circulated the globe a few times, and now everyone's repeating the bullshit version, but the actual truth of the story, which ends up getting added in as revisions and so forth later on, maybe upwards of 12 hours later, it doesn't really matter. No one's concerned with that story. They're all latched on to the bullshit version of the story. Mm-hmm. And it's completely irresponsible of anyone, I think, to do that, no matter what size, whether you're the New York Times or Liberals Unite or the Huffington Post or the Daily Banter, for that matter. You get the story out when it's right, not when it's first. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big problem. And we saw that in execution yesterday with the this new email story from the FBI, which turned out to be, the initial reporting turned out to be completely wrong, where they were all going around, most major publications, even some of them still retaining these headlines, saying that the FBI was reopening the email case, the email investigation over Hillary Clinton and her private email server. And that wasn't the case at all. They happen to find a bunch, and this is all reporting that came out after the fact. Mm-hmm. And again, the phrase, I should back up and say, the phrase is from Mark Twain, and he described it perfectly when he said that a lie can travel halfway around the globe before the truth gets its shoes on, or I like to say before the truth gets its pants on. But that happens to be the case with this latest story. And so they all talked about how the case was being reopened. It's not being reopened. The reporting that came out in the subsequent hours after the initial story broke, after the initial letter was sent by Director Comey to the various Republican leadership in the House, was that basically now what we know is that it's a laptop that Huma Abedin used. Anthony Weiner also used this laptop. None of the emails contained on the laptop were sent by Hillary Clinton. They were all emails that Hillary Clinton really had no operational access to. So it wasn't like Hillary Clinton sending Huma Abedin, one of her closest advisors, all of this classified material. That's not happening. We don't even know how many emails there are. We don't even know if they're copies of emails that we've already seen, because as you know, anyone who uses email knows that there are numerous copies on everyone's computer who's involved with an email chain. Mm-hmm. And there's all different kinds of ways to access those emails. So at this point, we don't even know whether or not the FBI has a court order to be able to even look at the emails, much less know what the content of the emails are. But of course, this gets picked up and run with as being some major new scandal, a reopening of the investigation, which was not the case whatsoever. And that's based strictly upon the letter itself that Comey wrote. And then you combine that with the reporting after the fact that indicated from various sources in law enforcement and the FBI and Justice Department that this was just a bad move by Comey, that that very little, if anything, of this has to do with Hillary Clinton. So there's some additional reporting that was out today from Kurt Eichenwald at Newsweek, where he was talking about how generally the operating procedure between Huma and Hillary Clinton was Huma would often print out important emails on paper, because that was Clinton's preferred method of reading emails, which isn't very nice to trees, but that's a different topic. And she would print out these emails and put them in an official courier pouch and have them couriered to Hillary Clinton wherever she was. And so that's how they would receive this material. And that's how, if there are any classified documents, they would have been printed and couriered. But we don't know if there were any classified documents. Meanwhile, you got Donald Trump saying that this is bigger than Watergate. He doesn't know what the fuck he's talking about, because no one knows. No one knows what's in it. And this is what makes the fact that no one knows, that no one has detailed what's in this laptop, that's what makes Comey's reaction so irresponsible, because he throws it out there knowing full well that all you have to do is say the two words, Hillary emails. Mm-hmm. And suddenly the Trump people and the entire Republican establishment erupt. Immediately it becomes conflated with scandal, Watergate, cover-ups, deception, classified documents, irresponsibility, all of the different things that go along with just those two, or as a phrase, that shibboleth. They say that, oh, all you got to do is say Benghazi. All you got to do is say Fast and Furious. All you got to do is say Hillary's emails. And then all kinds of inference is taken away by the Republicans, and especially Trump now. And Trump was in rare form on Friday. He just went off about this as if he had special insight into what was in these emails. And he doesn't.
Well, that's typical Trump.
Yeah, I mean, and forgive me for filibustering here, but I mean, this is what's driving me nuts, too, about the overall race, that in the absence of any breaking Trump stories, any big Trump bombshells like the Access Hollywood thing, in the absence of anything like that, Trump's numbers actually go up just by default, and Hillary's numbers go down just by default. And that's what there's something that's inherently odd and really off about that. And it plays to me to the double standard of this entire campaign, where Hillary Clinton is held to an entirely different standard of decorum, behavior, and a presidential dignity than Trump is. Trump can do all of these terrible things. I mean, the one thing I keep mentioning all the time is the fact that he has bragged repeatedly about going into the backstage area of the Miss Teen USA pageants, just specifically. And he said this is why he does. He goes into the backstage area deliberately to look at 14-year-old girls when they're either half naked or fully naked. And he's admitted to this, and yet he's still in contention. It's like a 45-46 race right now. It's going to be an under 5-point race, unless there's another Trump, big Trump bombshell. It's going to be under 5 points separating Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton when everything susses out on Election Day. And that's really, really discouraging, knowing that Hillary's emails, the sky is falling. Donald Trump does all these terrible things, is completely incompetent, running the worst campaign, is the biggest clown ever to step on the presidential political stage, and yet it doesn't really matter all that much. He can remain neck and neck with Hillary. That is utter bullshit. So there's my rant. Are we done with the show yet? I don't know.
Well, I would like to say, you mentioned today, so it is Saturday that we're filming this, but I'm not releasing this podcast until Monday.
Right.
So just in case, I don't know if we're going to be missing, if any big story is going to come out on Sunday or Monday morning that we're missing. So in case we do miss it, that's why.
Yeah, it's right about time for that. Who was it was saying last night on MSNBC about...
I was just going to say, I think it was on Lawrence, that if the Clintons have any kind of... bombshell on Trump, now's the time to release it.
Yeah, if they're holding anything back, now's the time. And I just keep thinking back to the rumors about there being a tape of him saying the N-word, which would, You know what? Honestly, I don't know if that would affect him all that much. As much as it probably, as much as it definitely should.
Well, it might because of what happened after the Pussygate scandal.
Yeah.
You know, he definitely, he saw a huge decline in the polls. So I think the same thing would happen. You know, I mean, it's like you said, it really sucks that they're neck and neck. It's unbelievable to me that, and I, you know, I don't actually, you know, we've talked privately about, mm-hmm. you know, like what if Bernie were the nominee?
Yeah.
You know, how obviously it's all speculation. We can guess all day long. You know, one thing I said was that I don't know that the, first of all, the Alicia Machado story probably would have never been an issue. Mm-hmm. And then on the heels of that came Pussygate. So I think that even though it would have been a big deal, I think that it wouldn't have had the same impact with Bernie as it does with Hillary, because she is a woman, because she is pointing out all of the horrendous things that he's, you know, she's making a big deal out of it. I don't know that Bernie would have done that. I think Bernie would have stuck to his normal narrative, which yeah. I'm not against, but I, you know, when you talk about I always want to say strategy.
Yeah.
When you talk about strategy, you know, I think that the Clinton campaign has really done a great job with the way they've gone after Trump. And for all those people, I've said this on one of my other shows, but for all those people who complain that, oh, I'm sick and tired, this election is just about mudslinging. No, it isn't. Hillary is on the stump and in the debates talking about policy and her platform, and she's very clear. And it's really also pissing me off. The people are complaining that this election is all about mudslinging, which, by the way, they say that every freaking year.
Yeah.
So it's nothing new.
Yeah, it's one of those things. The American people love to complain about things and then actually just endorse those very same things.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, we hate mudslinging until we see it.
That they give all the attention to the mudslinging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, it's just like when they, you know, oh, don't write about Ann Coulter anymore. If you stop giving her attention, then nobody will pay attention to her. It's a bullshit.
Yeah.
She's got a whole audience on the right that are paying attention to her. So we can't let her have the last word.
Yeah.
But you bitch and complain about, or, you know, people bitch and complain that journalists shouldn't cover her. Yet those are the articles that get the most views. Talk about climate change. Crickets. So I'm always going to complain about that because it just makes me so angry. I'm on a roll today. Everything's pissing me off.
Yeah, it's one of those days. I mean, after that Friday, I mean, I know exactly what you're talking about. You know, and I'm glad you brought up Bernie, because we've actually had lots of during the primaries, especially, we had our fair share of debates here between you know, discussing, because you were a big Bernie supporter and I was sort of on the fence between the two, though I was leaning Hillary. And I think in hindsight, I mean, looking at the way Donald Trump has run his campaign, I do have to admit, and I've said this privately on many occasions, that I had no idea that Donald Trump's general election campaign was going to be this much of a disaster. I don't think anyone predicted that it would. I think the smart money was on the fact that Donald Trump was going to enter the general election after the conventions and run a very low-key general election. In fact, they were talking about this. There's a new New York Magazine profile of the Trump campaign, which is very, very revealing. Lots of interesting things in there. And the plan was actually for, and this was coming down from Paul Manafort, the plan was for Donald Trump to remain entirely low key during a general election, make very few rallies, make very few public appearances, to kind of retain the focus on Hillary Clinton. Because as long as the focus is on Hillary Clinton, then Donald Trump does better. As I was observing earlier in the show, I would say, you know, in the absence of Donald Trump's scandals, his numbers tend to improve. And that was the actual strategy that was lined up for his general election campaign. It obviously didn't work out that way. Paul Manafort ended up leaving, and Donald Trump's campaign collapsed into disarray. Now, had I known that it was going to collapse into disarray, I might have been much more pro-Bernie than I was, because, of course, my concern all along was, can Bernie Sanders defeat the Republican machine that we all know and that we're all familiar with in terms of its dirty tricks and its mudslinging and everything that it does as far as deception and lies and bullshit stories thrown into the discourse? That's what I was concerned about, and obviously that hasn't come to pass. But you know, in terms of how all of these scandals would have played out, especially during the entire debate season was I think ultimately beneficial to Hillary more than it would have been to Bernie, simply because of the reasons that you outlined, the fact that she's a woman and she's able to speak with authority on some of these scandals that Donald Trump has found himself in from his past. And certainly I think a counterpoint against Bernie Sanders, had these issues come up and Bernie Sanders was the Democratic nominee, the Trump campaign and the Republicans would have hit back with, you remember the rape thing where he wrote, a novel, and he was talking about how women love to fantasize about being raped. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that would have been thrown up as a defense. Well, you know, and of course, Kellyanne Conway would have made such a, everything Kellyanne Conway would have said would have been pivoted back to Bernie Sanders and the rape thing.
Yeah, and I do think it would have been a completely different race. I think a lot of the same things would have come up, but also there would be different things because they were going to, you know, try to bury Bernie.
Yeah.
I think he could have handled it, though. I believe he would have won if he were the nominee, simply because he had a lot of support with independents. He had a lot of support with people who were fed up with the Tea Party. Like, for instance, there are some people in my family who are Tea Party, and they wanted Ted Cruz to be the nominee, mm-hmm. and they don't like Donald Trump, so they're not going to vote. I think that if Bernie were the ticket, and you know he was against Donald Trump, I think they would have voted for Bernie because this one, you know, it's a couple, and the man in the couple, he kept calling him Barney, but whatever.
Barney? Yeah, that's right. I remember that, yeah.
You know, he's like, he has some pretty good ideas. So I think Bernie could have pulled it off.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, he was my first choice, and I'm always going to, as much as I support Hillary and I stand behind her, you know, there's always going to be things about her that I don't like and that I want her to change. So, you know, I will stay on her, but that doesn't mean that because, you know, like I don't like her position on fracking. I don't like that she's not talking about the pipeline, but, and I don't like that she's not talking about the Equal Rights Amendment. I know she's a supporter. She's been a supporter. And again, I said, I'm going to give her the benefit of the doubt in the campaign season for the ERA. I think it would be beneficial for her to bring it up, especially since we're all unified. Women across the country are unified. And since, you know, about 70% of the population isn't even aware that the Equal Rights Amendment isn't ratified, it would be a great opportunity for her to kind of just throw that in there. Mm-hmm. But she's not, and I'm not sure why. I don't think she's anti-ERA or anything. I think she's got a strategy, and whatever that is, we'll see what happens. But, you know, I mean, and I'll push her. And so as much as I don't like some of her positions, that doesn't mean I'm going to burn the whole house down and give it to Trump.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, I'm just, you know, you have to be a grown up in this election and recognize what's at stake and, you know, recognize that a president is not a dictator and they can only do so much. And, you know, and we'll stay on her. And she's going to do things as president that I'm not going to agree with. But, you know, that's fucking life.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I feel like with the ERA, maybe this has to happen the same way that same-sex marriage occurred throughout the Obama years, which is that it didn't necessarily have to be a top-down kind of thing. It was more of a bottom-up grassroots movement that forced, first it was Joe Biden and then Barack Obama to quote-unquote evolve on the issue. And so it was the grassroots movement towards same-sex marriage and legalizing it at the state level that convinced Barack Obama to finally come out and announce that he supports same-sex marriage, obviously also prompted by Joe Biden's blurt that occurred like a few days earlier. I think it was on Meet the Press or something like that. But I mean, as far as the ERA, it seems to me as if that's one of those things where, you know, ERA activists like yourself need to generate this sort of critical mass where it's unavoidable. Hillary Clinton will have to comment on it. She'll have to get behind it if the grassroots are loud enough for her to
well, that's therein lies the problem, because I don't see that happening at this point unless something so terrible happened to somebody or, you know, some unfortunate situation, because people aren't even aware of it. How do you get a grassroots movement when most of the country isn't even aware of it?
That's true.
And, you know, I mean, I would love to, I would even risk arrest if I was absolutely if I had a guarantee that women in every single state were going to like for instance, chain themselves to some bridge, you know, at the exact same time, because then that would be newsworthy, and then it would make the media focus on it. But you know, one woman, if I went and chained myself to the bridge down here in San Francisco, I would just be arrested and look like a lunatic.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I don't know what it's going to take. And it just makes me mad. But anyway, going back to the idea that I think Bernie could have won against Trump. Again, we don't know what would happen. So right now we've got Hillary, and that's who I'm focusing on.
Yeah.
And you know, so there's that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my only other, and I do agree with you. I think Bernie definitely would have defeated Donald Trump, but my concern is that maybe the dueling populist messages would have canceled each other out. Where there is a distinct,
has the upper hand.
There is a distinct contrast between Hillary Clinton's platform and Donald Trump's platform, such that it is. And then when you reinsert Bernie Sanders into it, Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump have a lot of, at least for lack of a better term, populist overlap between mm-hmm. them as far as, yeah. You know, trade and things like that. And I wonder if that would have been enough to help Bernie if he was able to overcome the fact that they were both competing to see who was the bigger populist. So I don't know. I don't know exactly how that would have played out in terms of margins, but certainly Bernie Sanders would have easily defeated Donald Trump, knowing what we know now.
Yeah.
Knowing that his general election campaign is the biggest clusterfuck in the history of American politics, no doubt about that. And the fact that, and again, going back to what I was saying before, the fact that it's this close is just staggering to me.
Yeah, it really depresses me. I mean, you wonder, like, if it was a man that he was up against, would it be as close? I mean, I think actually it probably would.
Yeah.
And that's just the state our country's in right now. You know, that's what happens when Republicans keep defunding education and never replacing it, and people aren't educated and they don't understand how government works, and they just listen to, you know, add to that online, like you were saying, the blogosphere out there that gets things wrong, or, you know, the right wing extremist opinions and the left wing extremist opinions that are making people live in a world that isn't real. They don't, it's just not how it works, you know, and it's when you try to talk about that with people specifically on social media, they take it as condensation, condensation.
Yeah, they do take it as condensation.
You know what I'm trying to say. Anyway, they, you know, it's not being condescending when you just point out that this isn't how it works. And, you know, like, for instance, I made a Facebook post a long time ago, and I said, okay, to the people who are voting for Jill Stein or you know, the Bernie or bust crowd, what is your plan? And then I ticked off all these questions, like, do you have, you know, how are you organized? Who's your leader? What is your plan to defeat, you know, the Republican Congress, the hold on Congress on Senate, and blah, 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 blah. And basically, I didn't get any answers from anybody. I just got a lot of people yelling at me and saying that I was being condescending. And I wasn't being condescending because I was for Bernie. I wanted Bernie to win. And, you know, I love his message. And I always said that I would support and go behind Hillary, even though she isn't, you know, I don't think Bernie is perfect.
Yeah.
He had ERA on his platform, but he didn't talk about it. I mean, that's just a pet thing of mine. It's very important, yes, but it's a pet thing of mine. But there's, you know, I mean, I'm definitely somebody who, I'm not necessarily green, even though I took one of those tests once and it did put me in the Green Party. But I also understand that we live in a country that is filled with liberals and with conservatives. And so there's got to be a meet in the middle. There just has to be. And when, you know, the leftists aren't always going to get everything they want, just for the same reason that right wingers, I don't even know what to call them, they're not going to get everything they want. So, you know, we have to find this meet in the middle. And, you know, I'm just going off here. But this whole thing about Hillary Clinton, how I love when the angry left says, oh, well, of course the Republicans are voting for her because she's a Republican. It's like, oh, no. Yes, they've been after her for every little thing she's done for decades, yet they love her now? That makes no sense. It's the stupidest argument I've ever heard.
Yeah, really.
And, you know, I mean, I know that, you know, we've had conversations. We had a conversation recently privately about Hillary Clinton. And I was talking to you saying that, you know, it's funny to me because the right wing likes to give, and left, the like far left, likes to give her so much power. Like she, according to them, she controls everything in the world. She controls the media.
Yeah.
She controls the polls. Mm. She has everybody killed who doesn't like her. It's like, you know, she's a goddess or something. They give her more power, I think, than she actually deserves.
Like, yeah, I mean, and insofar as that rumor or that caricature of Hillary Clinton is real, I mean, I assume part of it is real. I mean, I don't know. I mean, really, I've been watching the Clintons since they emerged on the national scene in the early 90s. And, you know, I've seen a little bit of it. I've seen and I've heard some things about it. But I'm also putting all of that into context. And the context is in full view right damn now. In terms of what Hillary Clinton has had to overcome through her entire professional career, beginning, I mean, even going back to her childhood years, where she was constantly downplayed or not supported by her father. And then she goes on and she has to confront, you know, whether it's in college or out of college, going to D.C. and becoming an activist there, and then having to go back to Arkansas to support Bill Clinton and his efforts, and having to deal with the Good Old Boy Network in Arkansas that made her lose weight and change her hair and adopt a Southern accent.
And change her name.
Change her name in order to be accepted in Arkansas politics. Everyone wants to know, well, why does she speak in that stupid drawl sometimes? Because she was forced to, otherwise her husband wouldn't have been elected governor in Arkansas. So it's something that was kind of drilled into her head, and she understands.
Yeah,
that
she this was. Is what they blamed her for his initial loss because her name was Hillary Rodham.
Yeah,
and his name was Clinton, and they specifically blamed her for that. And it, God, it's just so stupid. And you know what I when we were talking, I had mentioned that. Obviously, you know, there's that whole thing where Bill was saying 8 years a Bill, 8 years a Hill. This has been their goal from the very beginning. So ever since Hillary was in the White House, she's been wanting to go back. And she's been doing everything she can. So what she did was she played the boys' game. She played the boys' club game. And she did, you know, make a lot of friends and scratch a lot of backs and you know, make a lot of promises. And who's to say that she's wrong for doing that? She was playing with the game that she had to play. And that's kind of my message to Bernie supporters. That's what we have to do. We have to play with the game that's available. It doesn't mean we like it. It doesn't mean that it's always fair. But, you know, the argument that, well, Bernie wouldn't have done it and Elizabeth Warren wouldn't have done it, that's maybe true. But they haven't been trying to be president for the last 20 years.
Yeah.
And also, you know, I mean, it's who knows if they would be able to win. Yeah. You know, everybody loves to just assume. I mean, I think Bernie could have won. But you know what? We don't know.
Yeah.
What we know is in front of our faces right now, and that's reality. And reality is this race is between two people. And, you know, it's frighteningly close.
Yeah. Well, you know, as far as the downsides of the system and playing politics and the things that have to be done behind the scenes, the sausage making, as they call it, this is something that is almost a necessary part of how American politics works. Some of the backroom deals and so on. A lot has been made about rumors regarding the DNC colluding with the Clinton campaign to make sure that Hillary Clinton becomes the nominee. Things like that, where, they seem by themselves, they seem to be really unsavory and kind of something that we ought to discourage. But at the same time, we also have to realize that there's another party out there, and they're doing similar things. And specifically with regards to flummoxing the Democrats. So you can't unilaterally disarm. You know, it's sort of the Cold War mentality.
I think the argument, though, is that when we do it within our own party to each other.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's one thing in a general election.
But it's all done with the aim of defeating the Republicans. The ultimate goal is whatever deals are made when it's an intra-party thing, like the primaries are, the goal is obviously with a long view of defeating whoever the Republican nominee is and preparing and leading up to that with either attaining the best candidate who can defeat the Republicans or establishing.
And then that's going to be, you know, who you think the best candidate is maybe not who I think the best candidate is.
Right, exactly. But all I'm saying is that it's all part of one piece. It's mm-hmm. not its own separate thing. Where right. something that happens inside a party, yes, it's inside the party, but the goal is ultimately to go on and springboard off of those things to take on the Republicans. So, you know, if you start to disarm your own side, you're asking to be defeated by the other side, which we all loathe. So, you know, if both sides decided, for example, that we're going to eliminate private cash in political campaigns, great. But for one side to just do it only handicaps that one side. It's like what Donald Trump is contending with right now. One of the major problems with his campaign is he decided to run his primary using his own money, not do a lot of traditional fundraising, not start any sort of fundraising effort, much less any sort of field operation until the general election was underway. So what has he done? He's handicapped himself in the face of a massive Hillary Clinton fundraising and cash machine.
Yeah.
And so that's put him at a significant disadvantage. He's not able to do the ad buys he wants to do. He has to parse everything out very carefully. He's put himself into massive amounts of debt that he hopes he'll end up recovering in the next year or so. It's possible. It's maybe out the window. $800 million or something like that, as reported by New York Magazine today. So it's these things that that we don't like. I mean, no one likes to see the sausage making, but there is an intention behind it. And as long as the activities are legal, I think that's where we draw the line. If anyone starts engaging in illegal activities, that's where we start to look at our own side and go, okay, well, maybe you shouldn't have done that. But as long as it's on the level, then it's okay.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's just, God, sometimes I just think, why am I even paying attention?
Yeah.
It's like, it's just discouraging and everything. But, you know, you have to look at the bigger picture. And the bigger picture is Donald Trump cannot be president. And the Republicans have to, we have to flip the Senate.
Yeah.
And the biggest reason, and I don't see enough out there making it so clear, but one of the obvious reasons is for the Supreme Court. And, you know, the president does the nomination and then the Senate votes. So they're the deciders on who's going to sit on the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And so many Americans aren't aware of this fact. And God, I mean, it's not only do we have to elect Hillary Clinton, we also have to flip the Senate. It's just vital.
Yeah, and even then, get ready to type these words a lot of times over the next 4 years. Republican filibuster, or yeah, how about these
yeah,
two
exactly.
words? Record Republican filibusters, because yeah. they're going to filibuster every goddamn thing Hillary Clinton wants to do. Every
yeah, because they love her so
ever.
Much.
Yeah, that's right. Remember for the longest time during the Obama years, the Republicans had nothing but great things to say about Hillary Clinton. It was nothing but how great Hillary Clinton was. Why? Oh, the nominee should have been Hillary Clinton. She was so great. And even some revisionism as far as their view of the Republican view of Bill Clinton, too. You know, these people say whatever the hell they need to get through the day. And that's the biggest issue with the Republican Party. They just don't have any long view strategy anymore. It's all getting through the day. And that's what makes them seem so contradictory. That's they'll say one thing one day and the next thing the next day, completely reversing what they said the previous day, simply because they're only reacting to what's happening at the time. They're not remaining or retaining any sort of consistency. Because now they've, especially with Donald Trump, they've sold out their core values. They have no more core values.
Yeah, and then there's Kellyanne Conway.
Yeah.
She's like the queen.
She's the worst. She is the worst.
I can't stand her. When I listen to her, I feel violent.
Yeah. On one hand, see, I'm so conflicted with Kellyanne Conway because on one hand, I really recognize how skilled
she is at doing what she does,
which is I've never seen anyone spin quite like Kellyanne Conway.
I love the way they do her on Saturday Night Live. It's perfect.
Yeah.
She just words, but you're right.
Yeah.
She's very skilled at what she does.
It's spin and filibuster. That's all she does. She says more words, less things I have to answer.
Mm-hmm.
So she'll spin it and then she'll take it down to whatever her message is for the day and she'll turn it into that. No matter what you say, you could go on there and say, I like turtles. and she's able to take that phrase and then turn that into...
And she'll say, but what about Bill Clinton? Because Bill Clinton doesn't like turtles, and I think he had sex with one.
Speaking of turtles, let's talk about the federal budget deficit. Now, the Democrats have been really bad about the federal... You're like, what? What did she just do? And then it just becomes... After a while, it just becomes... And I'm hearing... I'm no longer hearing words. I'm just hearing... clicks and buzzing noises from her. And that's where she's a genius.
She drives me crazy.
And really, that's at the core of what the Republicans do. That is the opposition strategy of the Republican Party, to inject reasonable doubt into every... They don't need to change your mind. They don't need to say, oh, well, here's why you're wrong on this issue, and A, B, and C, and D, here are the bullet points and all of the links that back it up and all the information. They don't need to do that. All the Republicans need to do, and this is from a strategy point of view, all they need to do is just inject that one little seed of doubt into your head. Mm-hmm. And then the people, and I'm talking about specifically the swing voters in the battleground states, like all they need to do is say to those swing voters, the ones who read like magazines like The Week, like all of these kind of nonpartisan or bipartisan publications where they've got one bad story about the Democrats and then another bad story about the Republicans. Everything is complete balance. And so when you throw something, some bit of Kellyanne Conway, reasonable doubt into the equation, they go, huh, well, she's got a point. I never thought about it like that. Well, maybe Trump, I don't know, Hillary, And so that's where you get, and then that's where they end up winning. They win in that little tiny gap. They're able to shove their entire agenda through this little loophole that they create through reasonable doubt.
And who the hell hasn't made up their mind?
Yeah, that's the other
thing. I mean, we say this every election, but it's true. It's like, how can such polar opposites up there? And I mean, remember when it was Obama v. Romney, and that seemed like a no-brainer. But this is just something for the books, and you know, people are still undecided. I will never understand that.
Well, that's, I mean, what we're seeing now with undecideds is we're seeing a lot of undecided Republicans just in the, I would say, maybe the last 7 days, especially after Friday's story. There, what we're going to see as far as polling movement is a lot of Republicans, quote unquote, coming home. Where a lot of Republicans say, all right, well, now that we're this close, I got to make up my mind. I'm going to hold my nose and vote for Donald Trump, even though I fucking
even though he
don't
would
like
rape
him.
My daughter.
Even though he would rape my... I wouldn't ever let Donald Trump babysit my children. You know, or even if I had teenagers, they wouldn't be allowed in the same room with him. But, you know, he'd make a great president. We should put him in charge of the nuclear codes.
Well, I'm going to switch the conversation to something else.
Okay.
Did you happen to see that article? And I don't even know why I'm asking you, because it's nothing that you would ever use, but I'm just curious to what you would think. There's an article in the Huffington Post about marijuana suppositories for cramps.
Oh.
And what's cannabis? And so the long and short is there was these two women who I'm kind of bringing this up because I've had my own issues with cramps in the past, which I'll get into in a minute. But so anyway, I think it's in cocoa butter. They put the cannabis in the cocoa butter. It's THC, the active ingredient. I think it's THC. But anyway, so of course they insert it into the vagina. And if you have really bad cramps, then it's supposed to alleviate those cramps.
Well, that's great. I'm looking forward to trying them out myself.
but I do know that, you know, I mean, there was that debate about free birth control. I think it was really started by Rush Limbaugh.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, you know, when I was in my very early 20s, I had such debilitating cramps that I was unable to move for like 3 days. And I had to go on birth control. And the birth control really did help. And really, it helped while I was on the birth control. And then even after I went off, I never got cramps again that were that horrendous. And so, you know, during this online conversation that everybody was having back in 2012 about free birth control, I chimed in on a conservative's post about how, you know, I had cramps. And this woman came on and she was so rude and she was acting as if I was lying about that. And I just couldn't even understand it. And and that, you know, that whole idea about free birth control, you know, that leads me to this, to leads me to that. And what it leads me to is your argument as to why we should have free birth control.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously,
free birth control reduces abortions. It seems like every fucking Republican out there who's anti-choice should be supporting free birth control. You should be able to go to a dispenser on every corner. Talk about taco trucks. Right next to all the taco trucks on every corner, there should be a birth control dispenser on every corner because it prevents abortions. I, for the life of me, I can't figure out. Well, I can figure. I'm just being hypothetical here. But I mean, you know, rhetorically, I can't quite figure out why the Republicans are so against birth control. Maybe it's because they just want to control women.
Maybe, you think?
Yeah.
And it makes me just want to put a marijuana suppository up my vag.
But again, you know, and the next thing they need to come up with are like marijuana dildos. So you get off and you get high at the same time.
Oh, but you don't really get high, just so you know. So,
well, see, that's not, why is that? That's no fun.
Well, but it alleviates the cramp. So that's the fun part.
That's true. But if it got you a little high too, well, now what's wrong with that?
Well, you can eat it, but I guess it makes you really tired.
You can eat it before or after you've used it.
Ew.
Gross.
That's gross.
But in all seriousness, I mean, birth control is one of those things that, well, what does it do? It prevents pregnancy, which then prevents abortions.
Yeah.
And there are all kinds of contradictions with Republican policy. I mean, the reason they're so desperately opposed to the birth control provision in Obamacare, and that's where it really got started. This is what Rush Limbaugh was reacting to, because right about that same time, that's when the birth control provision kicked in the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
And so that's when it was officially phased in. And so you had Susan Fluck commenting on it. Sandra Fluck. God damn it. I'm so terrible with names. But then she testified in Congress about it, but just to Democrats, because the Republicans didn't want to hear it. But so she went in and talked to some Democrats, and then Rush Limbaugh commented about that. And the main objection is that it was in Obamacare. That's the object, because for the longest time, the Republicans never really talked about birth control and their ridiculous opposition to birth control. We never really heard about that. It was kind of off the table for the longest time. We heard maybe a little bit of it in the 80s, maybe with the rise of the moral majority and all that crap. But in the modern era, we never really heard about the Republicans and their sort of underground opposition to birth control. Well, Obamacare gave them this big entryway into bringing it up again. And it was because this time specifically because Republicans use birth control. Republicans are using Obamacare health insurance policies. They just don't talk about it. So in opposition to everything that Obama does, they then included this. And it was there were all kinds of arguments and back and forth about it. I think one of the aspects of it that they really objected to was the quote unquote Plan B, or the morning after birth control, which
is now over the counter,
and one of the reasons why it's covered specifically by Obamacare is because it's not what they call an abortifacient. Is that how they pronounce it?
Abortifacient. I never know how to. I always want to go abortifacient.
an abortifacient is what it is. And it's not. None of the birth control covered in Obamacare is equivalent to an abortion. In other words, none of the birth control or the day after pills covered by Obamacare, none of that prevents implantation of an already fertilized ovum. What it does, the birth control that's covered under Obamacare, what it does is it prevents fertilization. It keeps the sperm out of the egg. And that by definition is not an abortion. What that is by definition an after the fact emergency birth control pill.
Oh my God, it just makes me so mad that it even has to be explained like that.
Yes, but
because
what they're doing,
it's nobody's fucking business.
Exactly. But what the Republicans are doing and what Rush Limbaugh and all the others are doing is they took that one form of emergency birth control and turned it into the equivalent of abortion. And numerous doctors, including the American Medical Association, for God's sake, have said that none of the pills covered in Obamacare are abortifacients. None of them are equivalent to abortion. In other words, none of them prevent the implantation of a fertilized embryo.
So they just want to make women into sluts.
Exactly. So again, it's all about controlling women's reproductive choices as a means of controlling women and women voters and basically turning them into gestation pods for the Lord. I mean, that's basically what the Republicans want out of women. I mean, I'm generalizing, of course, hashtag not all Republicans, but this is kind of what they're leading. This is part of the motivation of why they oppose this. this so much. And I had this other thing that you would think if they were genuinely, and of course, everything I'm saying about birth control and the Republican point of view on that applies also to their point of view on abortion as the sort of the A-list item in this line of conversation. What if they really were opposed to abortion, if they were really motivated by preventing abortions from occurring rather than just banning abortion in order to control women, is they would make, it's just three words, make pregnancy free. And this is something I've been talking about for a long time now.
Cue the freak out.
Yeah, that's right. So I mean, if they really
because then what you are is you're a freeloader.
Yeah, but what's one of the main factors in motivating someone to have an abortion?
Yeah, the cost.
It's the cost. It's the economics of it. It's a very, very expensive, especially for people who don't have health insurance, especially prior to the passage of Obamacare. People didn't have the money to be able to carry through a pregnancy to term and then to actually raise a child. There just wasn't the money there. So in an unplanned pregnancy, this is a solid and very legal way out. But if they really wanted women who were financially strapped to carry a baby to term, what they would do is make pregnancy free, which is to cover all of the medical expenses through legislation and through government spending, maybe reimbursements, maybe through some sort of a add-on to Obamacare, and then have postnatal care be also free, have free maternity leave and paternity leave for that matter. Making the process as easy as possible would also then prevent abortions. And they're not doing anything to prevent abortions other than going right to the heart of the issue and just trying to ban it outright by either banning it, making it really difficult to get, or saying that a fetus is somehow a human being that deserves constitutional rights.
Yeah, and it's just, that's why, you know, that's a big reason why I wrote the last book that I did, Peyton's Choice, about a teen abortion, because I knew that, you know, I know that there's places like Texas and Mississippi.
Yeah.
It's still legal in this country, but if you don't have access to an abortion clinic, then you're screwed. And, you know, a lot of these women have to travel and maybe take time off of work. They pay for the abortion, which is not inexpensive, as well as hotel costs, and you know, I mean, it's just they're so full of shit. They just make me angry because you know, and the thing is that if you're a Democrat, a liberal, a progressive, whatever, however you define yourself, if you're not a conservative Republican who wants to control women's bodies, you need to vote in midterm elections.
That's right.
This is what pisses me off about our side. We get really lazy. You know, in 2010, a lot of the, you know, Donald Trump is the result of the fact, a huge part of it. Maybe not the only thing that made this happen, but the fact that liberals didn't vote in 2010 in the midterms means that all these Tea Party people got in and they quickly did, you know, all kinds of, they figured out all kinds of ways, like trap laws, which is targeted abortion, targeted regulation of abortion providers. So, you know, you have a soda fountain or a drinking fountain in a hallway and there's not enough room, so shut the whole thing down.
Yeah.
And they found ways to get around it, and they were very quick, and they were successful. So, you know, if we had shown up and if we had voted, there was a lot of people disgusted that Obama was unable to wave this magic wand and fix. I mean, he did really do a great job in the first 2 years, but you can't accomplish everything.
Yeah.
And he even said when he was elected, it may take two terms to get some of this stuff done. Mm. Maybe even, you know, After my presidency, it's going to take a while because everything was so screwed up from the Bush years, and it didn't matter. This culture is all about instant gratification, and we didn't get instant gratification, and so what do? We punish ourselves, and you know, and so just please, even if you cannot bring yourself to vote for Hillary Clinton, vote down ballot and do it and get your ass out to. There's an election every year, but even if you're only going to, if you're just going to focus on the two main ones, you know, the midterms and the general, make sure you vote at the state and federal levels, because these are the people who are writing up the laws that you have to follow.
Yeah.
And they're taking rights away. And, you know, the moral majority, they used to be called the John Birch Society. It's all the same, and they have a goal. They want this to be a Christian nation run under Christian law.
Yep.
You know, if you want to talk about bringing Muslim law in, no, we can't do that. But Christianity, yes. So no, we're not supposed to have any religious laws in this country, yet they're finding ways to slide it in, and people just have to vote. We have to, we just have to be more, we have to do a better job. I don't know, you know, I mean, I'm always telling people to vote. I wrote a whole book about it called American Woman, the Pole Dance.
Yeah.
wink, wink, nudge, nudge. But, you know, I mean, I wish more liberals would stop complaining and go out there and vote.
Yeah. And you know what? Just to add this, that, you know, next year's election
can
is probably is just as important as this year's election. No one ever talks about the odd number years or the off season elections where there, it's not a presidential election. It's not a midterm. It's an off season election where you're just voting on governors, you're voting on state legislators, you're voting in local elections. These are the things that aren't sexy, but which have an amazing amount of importance. And part of the important aspect of these midterm elections is the reality that 23 states, nearly half of all American states, are entirely controlled by the Republican Party. Both houses of the state legislature and the governors are all Republican in 23 states. You know how many Democratic states are like that, where there were so-called trifectas, where all three parts of that that government is controlled by one party? Democrats control 7 states. Republicans control 23 states. And where have most of the issues that we've been talking about recently been focused? You know, all of these civil rights issues, mm-hmm. all of the reproductive rights issues, they've all been focused on, oh, and gun ownership issues, yeah. too, all been focused on state level laws yes. and state level governors and state level legislatures. And this is where the really important fight has to take place, and which is not taking place. Because part of the problem here is that, and I always go back to one of my big sort of hangups is, while participating heavily in it, I'm also seeing the extreme downsides of social media. And that is, we have a lot of participation in the political process now, which is fantastic in a lot of ways. But there is also a big downside to it, which with increased political participation, but a shitty amount of or shitty lack of education mm-hmm. in the United States, we have a lot of people acting and activated in the political process who don't exactly know how the political process works. And I'm just talking about even basics from who's controlling what branch of government or who's controlling which state governments or when the state government elections actually take place, because they take place, frankly, every year. And so these are things that are lost in the process. And there's got to be, well, and then you combine all of that with the idea that that there's no curation of the facts. There's no go-to source where everyone agrees that these are the facts about all of the issues and all the things happening in the world, and then we're just going to discuss how best to proceed forward dealing with these facts. Instead, everyone's got their own sets of facts and their own little bubble that they operate in. And none of this is good for the process. So you have a lot of participation, but it's ignorant participation in a lot of ways. And there's certainly a lot of smart participation, that's for sure, and a lot of insightful people who have emerged, like Kimberly Johnson, out of social media, who know what they're talking about. But likewise, you have a lot of people, and certainly most visible if you're being trolled by Trump people in your timeline or on Twitter. This is what we get. We get just a lot of people to know what the fuck they're talking about.
Well, you know, I would just like to say that prior to becoming a political blogger, and I was never a really that much of a political person. I became interested in politics in 2000 yep. with the whole hanging Chad Gore Bush fiasco. And then I stayed interested, although, you know, the interest has built over the years. Of course, you know, the 2008 election was a nail biter when Sarah Palin was introduced. And, you know, again, with each election, I've had more interest. But I'm one of these people who I complain about. I went to California schools, California public schools, which I've also been to Maryland public schools. And I will definitely say that Maryland public schools are so much better than anything that I, you know, ever encountered in California. And it's so sad. I don't, you know, I mean, I went to several different schools in California, but so I can't speak for all of them. I know that there's some good schools out there. I'm not trying to bag on all of them, but in my experience, I really didn't learn about, like, for instance, I didn't learn about women's suffrage in school. If they concentrated on it, maybe it was like in a chapter that we had to read and it wasn't even discussed in class. And I know that it wasn't, unless it was a day that I was absent, because I would have remembered that. You know, no matter what, I've always been the person who's been interested in underdog stories or stories about strong women. So that's something that would have grabbed my attention. And I had no idea. So, you know, I'm one of them. I'm one of these people that really didn't, I didn't have a full grasp of, I couldn't have told you 5 years ago about how a justice is appointed to the Supreme Court. I couldn't have told you, but I took it upon myself to learn. And, you know, I just would like for more people out there, if you don't, you know, you were complaining earlier that you get irritated just as I do when people want you to provide the Google link or whatever. It's like, Google it yourself. Look yourself. There's this wonderful thing called the internet out there, and you type in a few keywords and boom, you find it.
Well, what do we expect when we have a Republican nominee who very likely has not read the Constitution? I mean, in fact, in New York Magazine, he didn't know, according to New York Magazine, he didn't know what a Gold Star family was. He had to actually ask it, and this is true. He had to ask an advisor, what's that? You know, they said, do you realize the Khan family is a Gold Star family? His response, what's that?
So he cannot win.
So no wonder. And again, it's, you know, it's not a matter of having to go out and get a PhD in political science or something like that. It's just a matter of looking up and reading and making sure you're educated
and make sure that you're not going on sites that aren't recognizable. I mean, it's you know, I mean, I see out there, like, for instance, I used to belong to the Bernie groups.
Yeah.
And I haven't left any of them. My mother made a post because she was also a Bernie supporter, and she had made a post a while back saying she had to leave because those sites, those groups have devolved. And she's so right, because whenever I go on them and I look, you know, at the content that's there, it's either these blogs that I've never heard of, which are all opinion, and they're not backed up with any fact.
Yeah.
And if they are backed up, they're backed up with like Breitbart or The Blaze.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm sorry, you're not going to win an argument using the right-wing extremists, you know, papers and blog, you know, blogs and all that. It's like, no, I'm not falling for that. But they are. And it's so sad. So if you seek to educate yourself, and I hope that you do, if you don't understand something, like, you know, go to a place that is credible and learn how it works. It's not that difficult to find out what the truth is.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, I could complain all day long. We've been going at this for a while. I don't know if we should close it up, or maybe we could talk about something on a little bit lighter, leave people with a lighter, happier mood.
Well, sure. I think that's a good idea.
I don't know. What could we talk about happier?
I wanted to add to that. You know, I think in a lot of ways, what we'll see on social media most of the time are basically people trying to save face. They take a position. They've curated their own little micro bubble on their Facebook page. And they don't want to be told that they're wrong, and they will actually violently, in some cases, avoid looking up or reading things that will prove them wrong because they've created their own safe space, and they don't want to or have anything intrude upon that safe space. And so, that's kind of a problem where we should say, oh, you know what, I was wrong on that. You know, and I think that's oftentimes that's a lot easier to just say, you know what, I was wrong. I screwed up on this thing. Let's move on.
Well, you have more credibility when you do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, you should never be afraid to admit that you were wrong on something.
Yeah. I mean, as a blogger, you know, I've written a few things where there was a time in 2012 that I wrote when I used to write for Addicting Info. I no longer do. But when I used to, I can't remember what the story was, but I believe I had written about Rick Santorum's wife. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a miscarriage or something like that. But whatever it was that I wrote about, I got it wrong. And so, of course, everybody in all the comments were, you know, letting me know that I got it wrong. And I felt terrible. And I was unable to edit. I had to wait, you know, for an editor to be around that I could contact. And, you know, and then finally, you know, I got an editor and they went and fixed, you know, my mistake. Mm-hmm. But long story short, you know, I will it. My mom always said that. She always said, you know, admit when you're wrong, because when you do that, people give you, you know, they give you more credibility and they appreciate it. And it's absolutely true. So it's like, yeah, I mean, when you're in this 24-7 news cycle and, you know, information is coming every second, mm-hmm. We're going to get some stuff wrong from time to time.
Yeah.
But if we go back and we say, hey, I made a mistake, here's, you know, here's the truth, that's the best anybody can do.
That's right. That's right. And certainly with the amount of content that we both churn out, eventually there's going to be some sort of egregious error along the way. It's just the odds. That's the way it works out.
Well, anything else? Any fun bit you want to talk about, or should we?
Any fun bit?
Yeah, you know, I don't know. Like there's movies.
Let's go back to the marijuana tampons.
Okay. Oh, only if you could get high from them.
Yeah. I mean, the wishes you do next is make like marijuana toilet paper, where you're wiping well, up and actually, getting high at the same time.
I'm sure, ew.
Hemp.
I'm sure there's hemp toilet paper, but you still don't get high from it.
Yeah, so what's the fun in that?
So do you think marijuana should be legal?
Do I think? Absolutely. There's no doubt about that. Easily. Yeah, I mean, it's one of the biggest fucking, most ridiculous things that exist in political discourse or just in the law in general is the fact that this one thing that, you know, grows in nature and smoking it is illegal.
One could argue that tobacco grows in nature. Well, does it grow in nature?
I think it's agricultural development, and certainly I think some marijuana is too. So I mean that's not the entirety of my argument in support of it, but I mean I do think that you know, given the effects of marijuana versus given the effects of alcohol, I mean my justification for it is the simple. There's nothing complex about how I feel about this issue. If alcohol is legal, then so should marijuana be legal.
My father had said to me, he's like, well, how do you regulate it with driving and everything? I said the same way that you would with alcohol.
Yeah, except the difference is someone driving on marijuana is going to be going 15 miles an hour down the shoulder. I mean, not even in the lane. It's just like, no, really. But if someone on alcohol, I mean, when was the last time you saw someone get into a barroom brawl when they're high? It just doesn't happen.
No, people aren't violent when they're high.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, they're pretty relaxed and they like to snack and laugh. That's pretty much it. I mean, if anything, it would take the edge off if you're a naturally angry person.
That's right. And as we learned from the movie Knocked Up, it cures everything.
Which we just watched recently.
That's right.
You know what? I actually have to say that I liked it less. I liked it when it first came out a lot, mm-hmm. and I watched it many times.
Yeah.
I liked it less this time.
What's happening with those movies is that, and we're really way off the political path now, which is great. But the fact of the matter is that with those movies, the improv style of the Judd Apatow universe was very much of its time. I don't think it's playing as well as it is now. And the specific observation I have about that is there are a lot of scenes in those Apatow movies where you know they're in there just because the director thought they were just so precious.
Yeah.
Rudd had a really good run there. It wasn't really funny, but boy, he's a great guy. I'm just going to leave that in the movie.
Yeah.
So you see a lot of that where it's just like, it's kind of a love letter to the actors more so than serving the script or serving what's funny or not funny. So that's what I noticed a lot of in Knocked Up. And I obviously I don't think they're doing many of those kinds of movies anymore. They were sort of, I don't know when they stopped making them, but they're not really. Oh, well, I guess the Ghostbusters movie was like
which
that.
I should seen.
So never mind what I just said. Forget about it.
I don't know. I haven't seen that. So I can't
see. I was wrong. The Ghostbusters movie was very, even though it wasn't directed by Apatow, was with a lot of Apatow characters, a lot of characters from SNL, and by characters I mean actors, and they do a lot of improv, and you know, it's kind of worn on me. I when I see improv, I always hope that it's the Christopher Guest style of improv and not the kind of precious
which
Judd Apatow
favorite
rom-com improv.
Actually, yeah, we just watched the what's the name of it, the latest, the Netflix
Oh, mascots. Yeah.
Mascots. I thought that was pretty good. It certainly was not Spinal Tap, and it certainly wasn't Best in Show.
Well, the thing...
But there was some really funny parts in that, laugh out loud moments in that movie.
Yeah, and the best thing about that movie, which is on the latest Christopher Guest movie, the best thing about it is the mascot performances at the big at the big competition.
We can't give it away, but the one, the plumber.
Yeah, the plumber. I mean, whoever the fuck... came up with all of the routines for the different mascots, because there actually are mascot competitions.
Yeah.
And I guess they're kind of like this, where they're, in some cases, super serious and weird, almost like performance art,
yeah.
but with people in stupid giant mascot heads and things like that. And there is, I guess we could, I mean, are you concerned about spoilers, or should I not spoil
I don't think
the
we should spoil
one?
It. It's on Netflix for anybody who's interested. No, right. don't spoil the plumber thing. But
I won't.
The plumber thing, I have to say, that and Parker Posey's really bizarro mascot performance was awesome.
Really, she's like an aardvark, and she's
she is so funny,
and
I
it's
love her.
Super arty, like super serious, but it's an aardvark character. It's so funny. But the, and the plumber performance steals the movie.
Yeah,
that
it totally
comes down
does.
To everything. I mean, it's like in American Pie when he's fucking the pie. That's like the takeaway. Like everyone remembers in American Pie where the guy, I forget the actor's name, fucks a pie in the kitchen. And in this movie, I think the thing that everyone's going to take away from it is that plumber performance.
And now I don't even remember. Was John Michael Higgins, what did he do in Mascots?
Yeah, he was in it.
Not very much, though.
Not very much. Certainly, he was in the previous movie with, it was called For Your Consideration, with the Home for Purim movie inside the movie.
Yeah.
He was the, he was a guy who was in it quite a bit. In fact, and his funniest line was, "I'm 1/8 Choctaw." He's just John Michael Higgins saying Choctaw.
And I my little story about him is when I was, I think I was 15. Mm-hmm. It was the year I turned 15. My stepmother had signed me up for an acting class in Maryland because I lived in California, but I would go back to Maryland for the summer. So she signed me up for this acting class, and it was in the basement of this church. And so I went the first day, and Michael Higgins was the teacher. At the time, he was just Michael. And I remember I was 15 and impressionable, and I developed this enormous crush on him. So then the following day, there was a new girl who for whatever reason, didn't show up the first day. And she was also a tall blonde. So at the time, I think I was 5'10". She was also maybe 5'10". And we just developed this obsessive crush on him. Yeah. It was crazy. We couldn't stop talking about him. That's all we would ever talk about. We pretty much only talked about John Michael Higgins and General Hospital.
That's
that
right.
was pretty much it.
And of course, he completely steals Best in Show.
Oh, I love
He's
him.
He's the funniest
movie.
Thing in Best in Show. And he goes up to, who's running? Oh, it's Ed Begley Jr. running the hotel. And they come in to check in.
Yeah.
And John Michael Higgins is playing this flamboyantly gay character. And, what's it, Ed Begley Jr. up and down, just checking him out. And he goes, well, what are you, from Norland? Norland.
And so, of course, I love to call where we live in Northern California, Norland.
It's Norland.
As a result.
Right.
But yeah, he was an awesome acting coach. And then I actually went, this is kind of a stupid, funny teen story. This is how dramatic teen girls are. But I had, the following year, I went to it was like a week, overnight week camp at a college. And it was a condensed version of not the same class, but he was one of the teachers, one of many. So I was 16 this year, and I was so concerned with, I wanted him to like me, and I wanted him to think that I was so grown up and adult that I really didn't hang out with too many of my, the people my own age. I was trying to look like I was an adult, and I wanted him to think that I was different. Mm-hmm. So there was this one, I don't know, one time we were in the cafeteria, and I got this brilliant idea, and I thought, I'm going to pretend that I'm crying, and then I want him to see me. So I was, like, crying, and I had my friend, like, my friend had her hand around me, and I guess he saw me, and he asked what was wrong, and I don't remember what happened, but I just remember being so excited because he cared. Like, he cared that I was crying, and I look back at this teenage years, and I think, oh my God. But yeah, overall, Michael Higgins is awesome. He's awesome in every movie. I don't remember what he did in Mascots, but I do know he was in it. I just like anything that he's in.
Yeah, he's great. Yeah. And he didn't ask you if you were from Norland?
No.
Jesus.
I know he won't ever listen to this, but just in case, hi. Hi, Michael. All righty. So this has been a fun conversation.
Yeah, it's like your longest show ever. This is going to qualify as maybe the longest episode of Start Me Up ever.
Well, thank you, Bob, for being on my show and producing it.
Thank you. I'll see you in the living room.
All right.